do in collaboration with the following people. So my students, Nadi Kaz in Cambridge, and also Klavda. So I'm going to be interested in general relativity in more than four dimensions, which is motivated by string theory. I'm interested in exact solutions, explicit solutions of the Einstein equations in higher dimensions. So the last talk reviewed black holes in four dimensions of space-time. There are also explicit black hole solutions of the Einstein equation known in higher dimensions. So the first such solutions, the first rotating such solutions, were constructed by Myers and Perry a few years ago. The Myers-Perry solution is a solution describing a rotating black hole in any number of dimensions. It's topologically spherical, and it's uniquely parameterized by its mass and its angular momentum, just like the Kerr solution we heard about in the last talk. So that's one family of explicit solutions that's known. The other family are the black rings, which are known only for the special case of five dimensions, five-dimensional space-time. These are unusual in that they're topologically non-spherical. The topology of the horizon is S2 cross S1. The topology of a spatial slice through the horizon is S2 cross S1. These are rotating objects, and again, there's an explicit solution for these, but only in the special case of five dimensions. And these are all of the known explicit solutions describing black holes in higher dimensions. So ever since the discovery of black rings, people have been asking the question, well, these are quite surprising, what else is there? And so people have tried to prove theorems characterizing the topology, for example, of five-dimensional black holes. And so there are topological restrictions known on the horizon of five-dimensional black holes, but they're quite weak. And many other possible topologies could occur. Furthermore, we heard in the last lecture about trying to prove uniqueness of particular solutions. The first step is this argument we heard about due to Hawking, known as the rigidity theorem, that if you have a time-independent black hole, then it's necessarily axially symmetric. In other words, if you have a time-like killing vector for infinity, you get for free, if you work hard enough, a rotational symmetry too. Now, this theorem has been extended recently to any number of dimensions, but all it gives you is one rotational symmetry in any number of dimensions. And the explicit solutions that we know have got multiple rotational symmetries. So they've got more symmetry than we have any right to expect on the basis of general theorems. So it seems likely that, in fact, these known solutions are just the tip of the iceberg and that much remains to be discovered in higher dimensions. Solutions could exist with different topologies and, in particular, with less symmetry than known solutions. So that point of view is kind of backed up by recent studies based on approximate methods for tackling the Einstein equation. So people have developed methods for developing approximate solutions when the black hole has a large hierarchy of scales, for example, a ring in which the S1 radius is much larger than the S2. These approximate techniques point to the existence of many new solutions in higher dimensions. And another approximate technique that's been used is looking at perturbations of the known solutions. This is something that's been done very recently. For example, people have just started looking at perturbations of the Myers-Perry solution, and one finds, for example, that the Myers-Perry solution, certain Myers-Perry solutions exist, admit stationary, time-independent perturbations which break most of the rotational symmetry. And that could be interpreted as evidence for a new family of black hole solutions, which is bifurcating from the Myers-Perry family, which is less symmetry than the Myers-Perry solution does. So it seems likely there's a lot to be discovered, so the question is, how do we do that? So I'm interested in developing new techniques for solving the Einstein equation in higher dimensions to try and discover some of these solutions explicitly. So there have been various techniques that have been used over the last decade or so, for solving the Einstein equation in higher dimensions. Most of these are generalizations of techniques which have been successfully exploited in four dimensions. But in four dimensions, the most important technique, the one that's been studied most, is based on algebraic classification of the Weyl tensor. And so far, no one has really exploited this as a tool in higher dimensions. So that's the subject of this talk. So let me remind you what happens in four dimensions. So in any four-dimensional space-time with a non-zero Weyl tensor, there are four principal null directions. The Weyl tensor gives to you four preferred null vectors, or null directions. So at any point in the space-time, you have these four directions. In general, they're distinct. But if two or more of them are coincidence, then we say, and they coincide everywhere, then we say that the spacetime is algebraically special. A particularly important example of an algebraically special spacetime is the Kerr solution. This is what's known as a type D solution, by which we mean it's a solution for which these four null directions fall into two pairs. So the other algebraically special classes, well, the algebraically general class is usually referred to as type 1. This is when all the null directions are distinct. Type 2 is when you have two equal null directions and two others which are unequal. Type 3 is when you have three equal null directions and one other which is unequal. And type N is when all four of them are equal. Type D is a special case of type 2 in which you have two equal pairs of null directions. Now the important thing to note here is in fact the algebraically special property of the Kerr solution was crucial in its discovery. When Kerr discovered his solution, what he was actually doing was searching for new algebraically special solutions. So the algebraic special property was used as a tool for solving the Einstein equation. And this was the most spectacular illustration of this technique is probably Kinnersley's work from the late 60s, when managed to determine all of the type D solutions of the vacuum Einstein equation. So this includes generalizations of the Kerr solution to include what's known as a nut charge, but also interesting solutions describing black holes, accelerating black holes. There's a solution called the C-metric. The generalization of that to include angular momentum was constructed for the first time by Kinnersley in using this algebraically special property as a tool for solving the Einstein equation. So this is the kind of thing I'd like to push into higher dimensions to see whether we discover anything new. I should say we're at a very early stage at the moment, so there's not going to be any spectacular new results announced in this talk. I'm just going to tell you what where we've got to so far in this program. So let me review now how one classifies the Weyl tensor. So in four dimensions, there are two alternative approaches for classifying the Weyl tensor. The first I've just told you is based on this idea of principal null directions. There's another approach you can use due to Penrose, which uses two component spinners. Superficially it looks different, but at the end of the day one finds that it's actually equivalent to the method based on null vectors. So given any a Weyl spinner, you can construct an associated null vector and vice versa. So these two methods are equivalent. A few years ago, the Smet generalized this spinorial approach to higher dimensions. So what he did is he takes the Weyl tensor C and he contracts it with some gamma matrices, elements of the Clifford algebra. So gamma AB here is the anti-symmetrized product of two gamma matrices. C is the charge conjugation matrix. And alpha and beta here are spinner indices in five dimensions. So in five dimensions, the Dirac spinners, they have four complex components. So if psi is a Dirac spinner, it turns out that the symmetries of the Weyl tensor translate into the statement that P alpha beta gamma delta here is a symmetric object. Hence, if I contract it with four copies of psi, I get a homogeneous degree four polynomial in four complex variables, which are the components of psi. So one way of looking at this geometrically is that this defines a quartic surface in a complex, three-dimensional complex projective space. So that point of view hasn't really been exploited. What Smet proposed is that one should classify the Weyl tensor according to whether and how this polynomial factorizes. So here are some examples. For the Myers-Perry black hole, which is the high-dimensional version of Kerr, one finds that this quartic polynomial is actually the square of a quadratic. For another interesting solution, a black string is just the product of a flat spatial direction with the Schwarzschild solution, describes an object with a spatially extended event horizon along this flat direction. This also is algebraically special in de Smet's scheme. In this case, the quartic is a product of distinct quadratic polynomials. So this is one way that's been proposed for classifying the Weyl tensor. But this is very specific to five dimensions, and this method doesn't extend to higher dimensions. So this just relies on some special properties of spinners in five dimensions, or in four dimensions even, which are not valid in higher dimensions. So there's no way of mapping a general Weyl tensor in a general number of dimensions to a symmetric polynomial in spinner indices. You can see that just by counting the number of degrees of freedom in the two kinds of objects. So this is rather tied to five dimensions, so I'm going to focus on a different classification which applies to any number of dimensions, developed about 6 years ago by Curley, Nilsson, Carter and Pavlova. So the idea here is based on null vectors. So we introduce a basis for space-time, a frame field. So I'm going to refer to this repeatedly, so maybe I should write it down. We have a basis of two null vectors, L and N, which I'll refer to as E0 and E1, and a set of space-like vectors, Li, or called Ei, so I runs from 2 up to D minus 1, where D is the dimension of space-time. So here are the various scalar products between these various basis vector fields. So L and N, you can see, are null, and L and N are both orthogonal to the spatial vectors M. The scalar product of L with N is 1, and the M's are orthonormal amongst themselves. So the important property is that L and N is 0, L squared and N squared 0. Now clearly, there are many different bases you can choose, and different bases are related by SO1, D-1 transformations, Lorentz transformations. So these authors proposed that we should focus on a particular type of SO1, D-1 transformation and see how tensor components transform under this transformation. So a particular kind of transformation which preserves all of this structure is what's known as a boost, under which we rescale the two null vectors, L and N, but we leave the spatial vectors alone. So lambda here can be a space-time dependent function. I should write that down. L goes to lambda L, N goes to lambda inverse N, N goes to N. And then for a given tensor, we can ask how do its components transform under this transformation? And that leads us to the concept of boost weight. Clearly it's going to scale as some power of lambda. If that W, we'll say that a given tensor component has boost weight W. So the tensor we're most interested in today is the Weyl tensor. For the Weyl tensor, the boost weights range from 2 down to minus 2. So the components of boost weight 2 are of the form C0i0j, which is boost weight 2. Things like C0ijk has boost weight 1. And so on. The general rule is to calculate W is you just subtract the number of zero indices in your tensor component from the number, you subtract the number of one indices from the number of zero indices. So that's the Weyl tensor. So let me write that down as well. So the boost weight minus two components is C1i, one j. Okay, so now we introduce the idea of alignment. We'll say that our vector field L, which remember is the zero, is what we'll call a Weyl aligned null direction, if and only if all of the highest boost weight components of the Weyl tensor vanish in this basis. At first sight, this may seem like a basis dependent statement, but it's not. Its equivalent equation, which you can see just involves the Weyl tensor and the null vector L. So the concept of a wand, which is what we call it for short, is independent. Moreover, if we restrict to four dimensions, this idea reduces to the idea of a principal null direction, which is used, as I've explained, for the standard Petrov classification. And as I said before, in four dimensions, there are exactly four such directions, at least up to scaling. I'm always neglecting the freedom to rescale L. So that's in four dimensions. So what about higher dimensions? So in higher dimensions, things can be rather different. So there exist space-times which do not admit a wand. There are no Weyl-aligned null directions. So probably the simplest example, which was constructed by myself and Gdasgar, is to look at what's known as the static Kaluza-Klein bubble, simply the product of the Schwarzschild solution in Euclidean signature with a flat time direction. For this solution, there are no wands. Furthermore, as I've said, in four dimensions there are exactly four wands, but in higher dimensions, if a wand does exist, it might not even be discrete. So a simple example of that is something like the product of three-dimensional de Sitter space, a three-dimensional Lorentzian space of constant curvature, with a two-sphere. In this case, any vector field tangential to the de Sitter part of this metric is a wand. And clearly there is a continuous family of such null vector fields, and therefore there's a continuously infinite family of ones in this space-time. So in high dimensions, things are looking rather different. So the next step is to define the notion of a multiple wand. So we'll define a wand. We defined a wand to be something for which the boost weight 2 components of the vial tensor vanish. If we can make both the boost weight 2 and the boost weight 1 components vanish, we'll say that L is a multiple wand. In this case, if there exists a multiple wand, we'll say that our space-time is algebraically special. Again, this may look like it's slightly basis-dependent. It's not. This is a basis-independent definition. And again, in four dimensions, the notion of a multiple wand reduces to the notion of a repeated principal null direction, which is how one defines the idea of algebraically special space-times in four dimensions. So this is a natural generalization of what's done in four dimensions. It's largely because I'm mainly going to be interested in Einstein space-times, or even Ritchie flat space-times, for which the curvature is fully characterized by the vial tensor. There isn't anything else. Oh, you can do that as well. I mean, people have looked at such things, but then you're... This is the zero step, if you like. If you wanted, you can look at more higher derivatives of the curvature tensor. That's certainly something you can do. So indeed, any tensor, you can formulate natural ideas here. But the point is, in four dimensions, we know that the vial tensor plays a particularly important role in the study of exact solutions, so that's why we're focusing on it here. Okay, so now we can describe the classification, which is analogous to the Petrov classification in four dimensions. So we'll say that the space-time, or the vial tensor, is of type G if there is no vial aligned null direction. So this is like the static Kaluza-Klein bubble example I just mentioned. We'll say that space-time is type 1 if the boost weight 2 components of vial vanish. In other words, there exists the wand. So this is still algebraically general in my definition. And then we come to type 2, which is when the boost weight 2 and 1 vial components vanish. And so then we have a multiple wand, and this is algebraically special. We can then go further and consider cases when further boost weight components vanish. So if we have 2, 1, and 0 vanishing, we're in type 3. 2, 1, 0, minus 1, we're in type N. Again, in these cases, we have a multiple wand, which is even more something in type 2. And the analogue of the type D class in four dimensions, which remember contains the Kerr solution, we can also define. So this is in some sense a special case of type 2, in which the boost weight components of 2 and 1, weight 2 and 1 vanish, but also minus 1 and minus 2. This is equivalent to the statement that L and N are both for ones. So this, all of these other classes only refer to N, but for type D, we have two multiple ones. And finally, type A, trivial case in which the vial tensor vanishes. So let me give a few more examples. So the Schwarzschild solution, this black string solution, the Myers-Perry solution, or this product of de Sitter space with the two-sphere that I've just mentioned, these are all examples of type D solutions. So this is encouraging evidence that this definition of algebraically special in higher dimensions is doing what we want. It includes this class, the Myers-Perry class, which we know generalizes Kerr, and it comes out to be type D, just like Kerr. So that's encouraging. An example of a type N solution, gravitational waves, the PP wave type solutions. So these are space-times with a... describing gravitational radiation propagating through space-time with a null killing field. An interesting example of a solution, though, which is not algebraically special in this classification, is the black ring. Black rings illustrate an important point, which is that, according to this definition I've just given, the algebraic type can actually vary as you move around in space-time. So for a black ring, there exists disjoint open subsets of the space-time, in which the solution is type G in one subset and type 1 in another. This strongly suggests that the distinction between type 1 and type G is not going to be very helpful. Further evidence for that comes from the fact that type 1, we know in four dimensions, is the most general type. The question is, could this happen for more special types? And I don't think it does. Basically, what you find is that when you look at explicit examples, is that type 1 and type G tend to be distinguished from each other by an inequality, which clearly can be satisfied in one part of space-time but violated in another. But the more special types are always determined by equality, which if it's satisfied in some open set of an analytic space-time is going to be satisfied everywhere. So I don't think there's a formal proof of that written out anywhere, but I don't think it would be too hard to construct one. Sorry, type G, there is no wand. Type 1, there is a wand, but not a multiple wand. How rigid? We could ask the same question in four dimensions. If I take a type D solution, can I perturb it to get another type D solution? And no one's looked at this, is the correct answer. But in four dimensions, if you perturb Kerr and ask it to be type D, then you're led to either Kerr nut or to the spinning C metric, it's pretty rigid. I mean, you just get new constants of integration arising in that case rather than, say, arbitrary functions. But in high dimensions, no one knows. No one's looked at it. Okay, so our goal ultimately is to use this classification to solve the Einstein equation. So let's go back to four dimensions and ask how is it used there. So the key theorem in four dimensions is the Goldberg-Sachs theorem, which dates from the early 50s, which states that a four-dimensional Einstein space-time, which is not conformally flat, for such a space-time, a null vector field is a multiple wand, or a repeated principal null direction, if and only if it is geodesic and shear. So we're relating the property of being aligned with the Weyl tensor in a certain way with geometrical properties of this its geodesy and its shear. So this is very useful in solving the Einstein in four dimensions. It allows you to, if you say you have an algebraically special space-time, then this geodesic shear-free constant to write down nice coordinates, you can plug it, then look at the Einstein equation in those coordinates, and in many cases you can make a lot of progress that way, and that's how kids can do type D solutions, for example. Unfortunately, the extension of this to higher dimensions cannot be so straightforward. So there are examples of space-times with multiple wands for which the multiple wand is not geodesic. So I've already mentioned this case sphere. I said that in this case any null direction is a wand. Any null direction on the 3D part is a wand, but it's actually a multiple wand. So in this case, we have a continuously infinite family of multiple wands, and of course, not all of them are geodesic. Not every null vector field in 3D de Sitter space is geodesic. So therefore, we get examples of multiple wands which are not geodesic. And furthermore, it's easy to see that there exist examples in which you have a multiple wand which is geodesic, but it's shearing. So a simple example is this black string, which I've drawn here. In this case, the multiple wand, this is a type D solution, as I said, the multiple wand just reduces to a multiple wand or repeated principal null direction of the Schwarzschild solution. Such solutions are, such from the 4D perspective, the Schwarzschild perspective, these are null vector fields which expand isotropically. So from the black string perspective, you have a null vector field which expands isotropically in this sense. It expands isotropically in directions perpendicular to the string, but there's no expansion in this direction, tangential to the axis of the string. So the vector field is expanding in some directions but not others, and that's what we mean by a shearing vector field. So in this case, the repeated principal null direction is geodesic but shearing. So certainly, the extension of the Goldberg-Sachs theorem to higher dimensions is not simply that the null vector field must be geodesic and shearing, shear-free, sorry, it will have to be something else, something more complicated. So, this is something I've been working on in the last year or so, is trying to construct a higher-dimensional extension of the Goldberg-Sachs theorem. So the first step here is to look at the geodesic part of the theorem. So can we generalise the geodesity of multiple ones to higher dimensions? So the first step in this direction was taken by PPCM, which is a permutation of CMPP, who were responsible for this classification. They showed that for a type 3 or type N Einstein space-time, so type 3 and type N, remember, are more special algebraic types, in these cases, the multiple wand is necessarily geodesic. So the general case was then addressed in a theorem due to myself and my student, Mark Durkee, from last year. So we showed, so remember there are counterexamples to the statement that a multiple one must be geodesic, but what we showed is that in the Einstein space-time, there exists a multiple one if and only if there exists a geodesic multiple one. So although there may exist multiple ones which are not geodesic, if they exist, then there must also exist some geodesic multiple ones. So I'm going to give you an idea of the proof of this theorem. So obviously one direction of this theorem is trivial, that way. So the interesting direction is that way. We want to show that if there exists a multiple wand which is not geodesic, then there also exists a multiple wand which is geodesic. So the way we do that is through the following theorem. We characterize the structure of space-times admitting a non-geodesic multiple wand. So the theorem says that an Einstein space-time admitting a non-geodesic multiple wand is foliated by constant curvature, totally umbilic Lorentzian submanifolds of dimension 3 or greater, and any null vector field tangential to the leaves of the foliation is a multiple one. Now, let me remind you what totally umbilic means. So there are two equivalent definitions. So the familiar definition relates to the extrinsic curvature of the submanifold. So if the extrinsic curvature tensor takes this form, psi h, where h is the induced metric, or the first fundamental form of the submanifold, and psi is normal to the submanifold, then that's what we mean by the submanifold being totally umbilic. So in other words, if the extrinsic curvature has this factorized form, then the manifold is totally umbilic. This is equivalent to the statement that any null geodesic of the submanifold is a geodesic of the full spacetime. I'm not sure if anyone has noticed this before. So this is a peculiarity of Lorentzian geometry. It's only a statement about null geodesics. So these are two equivalent statements. So what that means is that if we take a null geodesic vector field tangential to one of these submanifolds and we lift it to the full spacetime, we'll look at it from the full spacetime point of view, then we get a geodesic multiple one. So the simplest example of that would be this example I've mentioned several times, this product of three sphere sitter with a two sphere. As I've said, any null vector field tangential to the 3D de Sitter space is a multiple wand, irrespective of whether it's geodesic or not. But if we focus on the case where it is geodesic, then that gives us a geodesic multiple wand. So that's how we prove the theorem. So, well, that's how we prove this theorem here. I haven't told you how we prove this theorem here. So this is the meat, of course, of the theorem. Let me explain how we prove this. So if we have an Einstein space-time, in other words, the Ricci tensor is a constant times the metric, then the Weyl tensor obeys the same Bianchi identity as the Riemann tensor does. It turns out that if you have a non-geodesic multiple wand, then the Bianchi identity imposes pretty strong restrictions on certain boost weight zero Weyl components. Remember, for a multiple wand, boost weight 2 and boost weight 1 Weyl components are vanishing, so the leading order ones, if you like, are boost weight 0. And if the wand is non-geodesic, then we get restrictions on those components. If we take those restrictions and make further use of the Bianchi identity, it turns out that one can perform a Lorentz transformation, what's known as a null rotation, about L, which is a particular case of a Lorentz transformation which preserves L. So it preserves L. Remember, our basis is over here. We have two null vectors, M and N. We're going to do a Lorentz transformation which fixes L, but mixes up N and M in some way. One can do such a change of basis to make N also a multiple wand. So L started off as a multiple wand. We've done this change of basis, and we found that we can also make N a multiple wand, and therefore our space-time must be type D. So that's already restricted it quite a lot. But now we can perform another null rotation. Once we've fixed N, we can now do a null rotation about N, which I've written out explicitly here. So this is a general form of a null rotation which preserves the vector N. You see it's parameterized by some functions Zi, where I runs from 1 up to 2 up to D minus 1. So these restrictions that we know from the Weyl tensor imply there's actually a space of solutions for Z, such that this new vector field L primed, which is the rotated version of L, is also a multiple wand. In other words, we have a continuous family of multiple wands, just like we had in this 3D de Sitter example. Furthermore, it turns out that these new vector field L primes, when I combine it with N primes, combination of the M's, it defines an N plus two-dimensional distribution. Obviously, it's an N plus two-dimensional subspace of the tangent space. And what we know from the Bianchi identity implies that this is an integral distribution, and that's where our submanifolds come from. So we get submanifolds of dimension N plus two, and since N is at least one, the submanifolds must have dimension at least three. Finally, we use our restrictions from the Bianchi identity again to learn that these submanifolds are totally umbilic and constant curvature. So that's how the theorem is improved. It's essentially applications of the Bianchi identity. In five dimensions, actually, the restrictions that you get on the Weyl tensor are much they're more restrictive than in higher dimensions, as you might guess. So in fact, in five dimensions, we can prove something much stronger. So if you have a five-dimensional Einstein spacetime, which admits a non-geodesic multiple wand, then there are only three possibilities. Either it's a maximally symmetric spacetime, Minkowski or anti-de Sitter, or it's a product of de Sitter with the two spheres I've mentioned, or possibly anti-de Sitter with a two-dimensional hyperbolic space. Or the least trivial possibility is a metric of this form. So this is a five-dimensional metric, which involves a three-dimensional space of constant curvature here. This is a Lorentzian space. So here, remember, our general theorem guarantees that such spaces have to appear. So this is where our constant curvature space sits. We have two other coordinates, r and phi. Those of you familiar with GR will probably recognize this solution as looking very similar to the Schwarzschild solution. And indeed, this is just an analytically continued version of the Schwarzschild solution, in which the spherical part of the metric is generalized to have to be a space of constant curvature of any sign. So special cases of this metric include the Kaluza-Klein bubble constructed by Witten, which describes an instability of Kaluza-Klein theory, and also the so-called anti-de Sitter soliton, which is important in the ADS-CFT correspondence as the description of the ground state of a confining gauge theory. So these are examples of spacetimes that fall into this class. So that's it. In five dimensions, these are all the spacetimes for which one has a non-geodesic multiple wand. So it's a rather special property, having a non-geodesic multiple wand. In higher dimensions, it's not so special. In fact, it's easy to see that there are many such spacetimes. So one way to see that is to start in six dimensions, for example, with a general static axisymmetric solution. So static means there's a hypersurface orthogonal time-like Killing field. By axisymmetric, I mean there's an SO D-3 symmetry, or SO D-2 symmetry, whose orbits are D-3, SO4 acting on these three spheres. So one can choose coordinates such that the metric looks like this. There are lots of solutions of this form. The general solution of this form is not known, I should say. One now analytically continues this, so that you replace T by I phi, so it becomes a spatial direction, and you can analytically continue the sphere to the metric on a three-dimensional de Sitter space, and this is what you get. And now we have our three-dimensional de Sitter space, and again, every null vector field tangential to this space, this part of the metric, is a multiple wand, and therefore we get non-geodesic multiple wands. Since there are many spacetimes of this form, there must be many spacetimes of this form, even if we can't say explicitly what they are. So this shows that that there are many more spacetimes with non-geodesic multiple wands in higher dimensions than in five dimensions. Okay. So this was all concerning the geodesic part of the Goldberg-Sachs theorem. So as I've explained, we have then a satisfactory generalization of that to higher dimensions. In other words, if we have a multiple wand, then we also have a geodesic multiple wand. But as I've emphasized, the black string example shows that a geodesic multiple wand need not be shear-free. It can be shearing. Nevertheless, the Bianchi identity and the Ricci identity, in other words, the relationship between the commutator of two derivatives on the basis vectors, gives us constraints which constrain the possible form of what's known as the optical matrix, which I call rho ij, which is the spatial part of the covariant derivative of L. So rho ij is what you use to find expansion, rotation, and shear of the congruence. So rho ij, grad j li. So the spatial part of the symmetric part of rho ij is the shear. Sorry, the symmetric traceless part of rho ij. The anti-symmetric part is the rotation, and the trace is the expansion of this null vector field. So this is a thing to understand in order to generalize the Goldberg-Stax theorem. So as I said, there are strong constraints on the form of this coming from the Bianchi identity. And so these are essentially algebraic constraints, so it becomes a problem in linear algebra to disentangle these constraints and determine the most general solution for rho ij. This so far has not been done. I should give you one example where it has been done, in fact. That's for the special case of type n. So for type n, it was shown by Pravda and collaborators that there exists a choice of the spatial basis vectors, these mi, in other words, choice of basis, such that rho ij takes the following form. It's a 2x2 block. With zeros everywhere else. Okay, you can see if we were in four dimensions, then since this is a d-2x d-2 matrix, so in four dimensions it would be a 2x2 matrix, so all we'd have is this 2x2 block, and you can see that the shear of this 2x2 block vanishes. In other words, the symmetric part of this is isotropic in four dimensions. In higher dimensions, that's not true. So this is the only case in which the constraints on the row have been solved for the type n example. So the question is, can we generalize that to the general case? And once you've done that, once you've determined what constraints the Bianchi identities impose on row ij, we'll then have to look at the converse. Remember, the Goldberg-Stax theorem is an if and only if statement. So in other words, does that general solution we have for row ij then imply that L must be a multiple wand? So this is something we're looking at the moment. So far that's not been completed. Instead, what I'd like to mention now is a kind of warm-up exercise for pushing through this program, which is to consider, instead of considering algebraically special Weyl tensors, instead to consider algebraically special Maxwell fields, because these are simpler to understand because they satisfy simpler equations of motion. So let's consider a Maxwell P plus 1 form, so a P form potential with a P plus 1 form field strength, and we'll say that F is algebraically special if and only if L is multiply aligned with F, by which I mean, in the same sense as for the Weyl tensor, that the two highest boost weight components of F vanish. So F has components starting at boost weight 1, so they should vanish. That's analogous to the statement that L should be a wand. I also say that the boost weight 0 component should vanish. I'm saying that L should be analogous to a multiple wand, except that now we're talking about alignment with respect to a Maxwell field rather than a Weyl tensor. So in four dimensions, this problem's been solved. So in a four-dimensional space-time, L, a vector field L, a null vector field L, is multiply aligned with a non-zero 2 form, which solves the Maxwell equations, if and only if it is geodesic and shear-free. Now this is quite remarkable because this is exactly the same as one gets from the Goldberg-Stax theorem. In other words, the condition for L to be multiply aligned with a Maxwell field is exactly the same as for it to be multiply aligned with the Weyl tensor. So this kind of suggests that maybe this idea of looking at Maxwell fields may not be so bad after all, because in four dimensions it gives the same answer as Goldberg-Stax. So maybe if we can understand Maxwell fields, we'll be able to figure out what Goldberg-Stax should look like in higher dimensions without too much work. Unfortunately, that's not quite true. So again, if I introduce my matrix rho ij, as I've just explained here, so it's the shear, the rotation, and the expansion of my null vector field L, then one can show that if L is multiply aligned with a non-zero P plus 1 form solving the Maxwell equations, then the symmetric part of rho has P eigenvalues which sum to rho over 2. So rho here, without any indices, is the expansion. In other words, the trace of the matrix. So it's interesting to compare this with what we know about null vector fields aligned with the Weyl tensor. So let's just look at the Schwarzschild solution for a minute. So in the Schwarzschild solution, the multiple wand is isotropic, rho ij is isotropic. All of its eigenvalues are the same. They're equal to trace over d minus 2. So if you combine these two results, you learn that a null vector field L can be multiply aligned both with the Weyl tensor and with a P plus 1 form solving the Maxwell equations in the Schwarzschild background, if and only if D, the space-time dimension, is twice P plus 1. In other words, your Maxwell field has rank, which is equal to half the dimension of the space-time. So, for example, a 2 form in 4 dimensions. So this shows that in a general number of space-time dimensions, in particular in an odd number of space-time dimensions, any hope of that the Goldberg-Sachs theorem could be understood by looking at Maxwell fields is probably not going to be borne out, except possibly in this special case of even dimensions with a form of half a dimension of the space-time in rank. Okay, so we're going to have to go back to looking at the Bianchi identity and understand the Weyl tensor rather than looking at Maxwell fields. Okay, so the next part of my talk, I want to describe what we've done so far to use this algebraically special property to actually solve the Einstein equation in higher dimensions. So this, as I've said, this is very early days, and there's not been a great deal of work in this field. So this is the first attempt at getting somewhere. So so far, what we know about this form of rho ij is not restrictive enough for a direct assault on the Einstein equations just with the algebraically special property to succeed. Instead, we have to put in some extra assumptions. We're going to put in an extra assumption concerning the symmetries of the space-time. So we're now going to assume that our space-time is axisymmetric, by which I mean that there's an SOD minus 2 symmetry, isometry, with whose orbits are d minus 3 spheres. Now, in more than 4 dimensions, if this is the case, then the action of SOD minus 2 is orthogonally transitive, which just means that the subspace of the tangent space orthogonal to the orbits of the isometric group is integrable. Or in other words, you can just decompose the metric into a 3-dimensional part and these d minus 3 spheres. That doesn't work in 4 dimensions. A simple example of that is the Kerr solution, where, roughly speaking, you can have d phi dt cross terms in the metric. So this is the distinction between 4 dimensions and higher dimensions. So this is the class of space-times we're going to consider. This contains many interesting solutions. So, for example, the Schwarzschild solution, the black string solution. These are known explicitly. More interesting solution in this class, which is known to exist numerically, but not been found as an explicit solution, are so-called non-uniform black strings. So remember, I've already discussed black strings that look like this. Numerically, people have constructed black strings which look like that. The translational symmetry along the string is broken. So that's an interesting class of solutions, an interesting solution in this class. Another interesting solution which belongs to this class that some of you may have heard of are so-called Randall-Sundrum black holes. These are black holes in a Randall-Sundrum brain world. Again, they fall into this class of metrics if they exist. So these are the solutions you want to understand. So notice I'm not assuming anything about the time dependence. So the solutions in this class are generally time dependent. And let me emphasize that even if we did assume time independence, in other words, if we assume staticity, then the most general solution in this class is not known. It's known in 4 dimensions, but not in higher dimensions. So our goal, then, is to see whether this algebraically special property will allow us to actually overcome this problem and solve the Einstein equation explicitly in this class. And so maybe I should say something about what the analogue of this in 4 dimensions is. So I said in 4 dimensions this orthogonally transitive property doesn't hold. So we have to identify the extra condition that enables us to split the metric like this. In fact, it was done a long time ago by Kramer and Neugebauer. So the 4D analogue of the class of space-times I'm interested in are space-times admitting a hypersurface orthogonal space-like Killing vector field. So Kramer and Neugebauer classified all algebraically special solutions with these symmetries, and they show they fall into 2 classes. These are two well-known classes of four-dimensional solutions. The so-called Robinson-Troutman class of solutions, by definition, these are solutions which admit a null geodesic congruence with vanishing shear and also rotation, but non-vanishing expansion. So there's a hypersurface orthogonal shear-free null geodesic congruence, which is expanding. So particular solutions in this class include the Schwarzschild solution and this C-metric, which I mentioned earlier. The other family in four dimensions are the Kuhn solutions, which are exactly the same, but with vanishing expansion. So these are the two possibilities. So they determined these solutions explicitly. Interestingly, just as an aside, if one focuses on the Robinson-Troutman class with it defined by these properties, then these have actually already been investigated in higher dimensions, and one finds that in higher dimensions this class is much less rich than in four dimensions. So these assumptions about the shear and rotation and so on are much more restrictive in higher dimensions, and essentially all you're left with is the Schwarzschild solution. So probably, as I've emphasized, that's because vanishing shear is not the right thing to look at in higher dimensions. Okay, so let's go back to our results. We're looking at algebraically special axisymmetric space-time. We'll assume the space-time is Einstein. By our previous results, we know that the multiple wand L can be taken to be geodesic. So there are two cases, the solutions fall into two classes. In the first class, the multiple wand is not axisymmetric. In other words, not invariant under the SOD minus 2. Therefore, if you act with the SOD minus 2, you generate a continuous family of multiple wands, and one can solve the Einstein equations to show that there are only two solutions in this class. One is the so-called Kaluza-Klein bubble, which I mentioned earlier, which is an analytically continued version of the Schwarzschild solution. This is just the metric on D minus 2-dimensional de Sitter space, which is D minus 3 spheres of the axisymmetry sitting inside it. So that's one of the solutions. And the other is the this product of de Sitter space with a 2-sphere, which I've mentioned before. So both of these are examples of type D space-times. No, it doesn't. We'll see in a minute that that's not true. In this case, it does, essentially because... In this case, basically, you can argue the space-time is, you could apply the analogue of Birkhoff's theorem. That's essentially because this wand is not axisymmetric, so you get a large family of them. So in the general, the other case, L is axisymmetric. The wand is invariant under the axisymmetry. In this case, there are three types of solution. There's a generalization of the Schwarzschild solution, type D. This is just the generalization where you allow the curve, the sphere to be replaced by space on a general curvature, so that's not so exciting. Generalization to the black string of a similar type, again, not so exciting. These were all known already. And perhaps the most interesting class are the so-called Kuhn solutions, which we've already seen in four dimensions. So these are axisymmetric by construction, and these turn out to be type 2 or more special. So they don't. All the other space times I've mentioned are type D. These are only type 2 in general. This is what they look like. So I choose coordinates. So in these space times, the wand L is geodesic and hypersurface orthogonal. I can choose a coordinate R to be the affine parameter along these geodesics, and I choose my geodesics to lie in surfaces of constant V, which I can do because I know it's hypersurface orthogonal. And then I introduce another coordinate Z to complete my coordinates, and the metric looks like this. So the Einstein equations in this case allow for arbitrary dependence on V. There's arbitrary dependence on V is like the time coordinate, so there's arbitrary time dependence. The dependence on R, the direction along the wand, is completely fixed. You can determine that explicitly. And the dependence on Z reduces to ordinary differential equations. So in that sense, these solutions are not completely explicit because these ODEs we can't solve explicitly, but they are just ODEs rather than the PDEs of the Einstein equation. So let me mention some special types, some special cases that belong to this class. If we say, so we've classified the more special types in this class. If we want the space-time to be type N, one can construct the solution explicitly. These just describe certain gravitational waves that are axisymmetric in Minkowski or anti-de Sitter space. We can show there are no type 3 solutions. Perhaps the most interesting are the type D solutions, which for which the metric simplifies considerably. One can show the metric becomes cohomogeneity 1. In other words, it's foliated by homogeneous hypersurfaces. These hypersurfaces are D minus 3 spheres times a two-dimensional Lorentzian space of constant curvature. Well, initial conditions specify the function. It's just a profile. It's like a wave, right? You can specify a profile for a wave, and that's what the wave... I mean, the metric involves a function f of v, which you can take to be whatever you want. It's an arbitrary function of v. Yeah, essentially, if you want to, yeah, but if you want to view it in terms of space-like initial data, then yeah, you specify initial conditions. So in the type D case, it becomes much more restricted. The metric depends only non-trivially on one coordinate, which is z, which is determined by solving these ODEs, which again, we still can't solve explicitly. This metric is something that's very similar to metrics which have been discussed in the math literature. In particular, if we take this Lorentzian space of constant curvature, have positive curvature, then these space-times are just analytically continued versions of the Böhm metrics. So Böhm constructed examples of inhomogeneous Einstein metrics on spheres in various dimensions. And so one way of getting to our solutions is to analytically continue some of his solutions. And if we take a negative cosmological constant, these metrics can have ADS-CFT correspondence. They can describe gauge theory in a space-time consisting of the product of this two-dimensional space with this D minus three-dimensional space. An example would be something like gauge theory in ADS-2 cross S D minus three, or de Sitter 2 cross S D minus three, so on. These are solutions which provide the gravitational duals of such theories, of such states. So that's type D. The general case, though, if we go back to this, the most natural interpretation of this is that it describes a gravitational wave introduced into this space-time, which propagates along this two-dimensional Lorentzian space and breaks the symmetry of that space. Okay, so that's all I've got to say about the explicit solutions. So this is essentially the only progress that's been made so far in using the algebraically special property to solve the Einstein equation. So let me now move on to a new topic, which is the GHP formalism. So many of you will be familiar with the four-dimensional Newman-Penrose formalism, which is a very nice approach to general relativity, where it essentially consists of working in a null basis analogous to the one I've been using, and writing out all components of all equations in that basis. That may sound like a crazy thing to do, but in fact it's very useful, essentially because all of the partial derivatives, all the covariant derivatives, sorry, in GR you have to deal with covariant derivatives, but in Newman-Penrose formalism, you only ever have to deal with partial derivatives, such as the thing they call capital D, which is just the derivative in the direction L, and so on. A very useful approach in four dimensions. However, it's got a certain amount of redundancy in it, which is not so nice. So often one is interested in space-times which have two preferred null directions. So for example, a type D space-time, or a space-time which has a preferred family of two surfaces, in which case you have two null normals to those surfaces. And under those circumstances, all you're interested in really is the null directions, and you don't really care too much about how you choose these spatial basis vectors. So this led Garoche, Held, and Penrose in the late 60s, maybe the early 70s, to an improved formalism, an improved version of the Newman-Penrose formalism, which maintains covariance under rotations of the spatial basis, and moreover under boosts, under which we rescale L and N by some function lambda. So this covariance leads to a huge reduction, roughly by a factor of 4, in the number of equations that one has to consider. And so it's a very useful formalism for doing calculations, especially for algebraically special solutions in four dimensions. So we've recently extended all of this to higher dimensions. I'm not going to give you the details, because unless you're familiar with the 4D case, then everything will just look horribly complicated, even though it's not. But the basic idea is you introduce new derivative operators, which contain certain connection terms, the modified versions of the Newman-Penrose derivatives, and you write out all components of the Bianchi and Riccio identities explicitly. And there's a huge reduction here over what you'd get if you just used the analogue of Newman-Penrose. One reason for doing this is related to perturbations. So in four dimensions, in the early 70s, people were interested in the question of the classical stability of the Kerr solution. They wanted to study gravitational perturbations of Kerr to understand whether Kerr was stable or not. Tucholsky famously showed that you could reduce that down to a single wave equation. It looked rather miraculous at the time, but later Stewart and Walker gave a nice explanation of Tucholsky's calculation using the GHP approach, which leads to a very streamlined analysis of the perturbations. So it's natural to use this high-dimensional GHP formalism to analyse perturbations of high-dimensional rotating black holes, which is a subject of interest at the moment. So that's something I've been looking at with my student, Mark Durkee. So the idea, following Tucholsky, is to focus on the components of highest boost weight of the Weyl tensor, which I'll call omega. So this is a D-2 by D-2 traceless symmetric matrix. The nice thing about this is that even in higher dimensions, this is gauge invariant. It's invariant under infinitesimal diffeomorphisms and also under infinitesimal changes of the basis. So it's a very natural thing to work with. In a general space-time, you don't have anything like this. You don't have a local gauge invariant quantity. And furthermore, it has the same number of degrees of freedom as the graviton, so it's got enough components to capture all of the degrees of freedom of the graviton, so it could be sufficient to work with this quantity. And in four dimensions, this is the quantity that Tucholsky studied, psi zero, which satisfies a single wave equation on its own. So it's a natural question to ask, in higher dimensions, does this omega also satisfy a decoupled equation? Unfortunately, well, we studied this, and unfortunately the answer is no in general. We find that omega decouples if and only if, sorry, in four dimensions, omega decouples if and only if L is geodesic and shear free, which is guaranteed by the Goldberg-Sachs theorem in four dimensions. In higher dimensions, though, we find that decoupling is more restrictive, and that L must, in addition to being geodesic and shear free, it must also have vanishing expansion and rotation. So this implies that this miraculous decoupling that was discovered by Tucholsky is very much tied to four dimensions, and there's no analogous phenomenon for the Myers-Perry solution, or even the Schwarzschild solution, in higher dimensions. As a final point, it's not all doom and gloom, though. If one considers the special case of a maximally rotating Myers-Perry black hole, that has a well-defined near-horizon geometry, and one can and these properties are actually satisfied for that near-horizon geometry. So one can study perturbations of near-horizon geometries of black holes using this formalism. Okay, this is my final slide. So I think there's a lot to do. As I've explained, we've been working towards a generalization of the Goldberg-Sachs theorem to higher dimensions. The step that remains to be solved is the generalization of the shear-free part of that theorem, which is a problem in linear algebra, essentially, so hopefully that can be sorted out. More ambitiously, what we want to do is to determine all algebraically special solutions in certain classes. So, I mean, for example, would be to determine all type D in higher dimensions. Maybe that's too hard, but if it is, we can do what we've just been doing, which is to symmetries on the algebraically special problem. As I've just said, perturbations of near-horizon regions of black holes, doing that. And then going back to this spin about rather mysterious and hasn't really been discussed much. How is it related to this other classification scheme, and what can we do with it? Can we exploit this very different scheme as a method for solving equations? And since it's so different from this scheme based on null direction, maybe it will lead to solutions with very different and unexpected properties. So that's also something we'll be looking at in the future. So thank you. So the dependence along the on R, I think you can understand that. So here's the direction along the. So it's not so surprising you can constrain what's happening in the R direction. That essentially, it's coming from the Rater-Jurius propagation of shear and rotation. so those will constrain the R dependence. As I said, the V dependence is arbitrary. I think about it in terms of initial data. So suppose initial data on a null hypersurface, then I can specify a function of V on that hypersurface to determine the initial data. And then maybe I could view Z or Z as the what I get by evolving in the... Oh, yes, good question, yes. I think it might. certainly in the cases where it exists in some part of the space-time and not in others, I think if you let it become complex, then you're probably okay. If it doesn't exist, I'm not sure whether one could prove that it always exists. It might even be possible to prove that, yeah. Well, no. Essentially, for this reason I mentioned here, in higher dimensions, Robinson-Trautmann is much more restrictive. And essentially, all you get is the Schwarzschild solution. In four dimensions, as you said, you get this rich structure. We get an interesting PDE out, which a lot of people have spent a lot of time studying. And one can study solutions, for example, which asymptotically approach the Schwarzschild solution at late times and things like that. But in higher dimensions, the Robinson-Trautmann class is much more highly restricted. At a technical level, the reason for that is when you solve the Einstein equation, you get terms coming out like 1 over r squared, and also terms like 1 over r to the d minus 2. And the r dependence is fully determined, so you can equate coefficients of terms involving different powers of r. In four dimensions, these are the same power, so you only get one equation. In more than four dimensions, these are different powers, so you get two equations, and things are more highly constrained. So I think there may be some analogue of the Robinson-Trautmann class, but it will be shearing. Yeah, so there will be some other restriction on rho which leads to an analogous structure. That's my guess. Clearly there must be such solutions, because a trivial example would be to take a 4D Robinson-Trautmann solution and take the product of that with a flat direction. That gives a 5D solution, which is algebraically special, but it's shearing. But obviously it has exactly the same PDE as you get for Robinson-Trautmann.
So I don't
Well, that's an alternative approach to people view. I mean, that's strongly related to looking for supersymmetric solutions. I think there are some connections, obviously, between the Weyl tensor and the existence of reduced holonomy, but they're not kind of one-to-one type connections. So certainly looking for solutions, for example, with killing spinners is something that people have explored a lot in GR, especially motivated by supersymmetry. There is a body of literature on that. But often you have to put in more fields than just gravity to consider. Maxwell fields coupled to gravity, for example. Otherwise you just tend to end up with things like waves, TP waves.
Okay, so we're going to just take 11 minutes late and start up the 11.